How can we harness the power of companies to reduce plastic waste? On the latest episode of Sustainably Speaking, learn how companies are helping to boost the amount of recycled plastic available so that more is used in new products and packaging.
Hi, this is Kevin McCullough. Thanks for listening to the Christian Outlook podcast, where we cover today's issues from a perspective that honors your Christian faith. Our podcast is brought to you through a partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Here's another piece I trust you'll enjoy.
Well, I have been looking forward to this hour for a long time. I've been doing this daily for over 21 years. I've been doing a talk show on WRFD for about 31 years, and I have had a boatload of guests in all of those years. And honestly, right at the top of my list of my favorite guests is my guest sitting across the table from me, Bill Federer, founder of the American Minute. He is a prolific author. He is a historian. And Bill, I gotta tell a quick story before we get into the interview. The first time I heard you, I think, was at an Ohio Christian Alliance banquet. I had never heard of you. I thought, who is this Federer guy? Never heard of him. He's written books and all that, and you know. And we sat at the table together, and I thought, well, he's a nice guy, you know. Being a public speaker myself, I can be critical of public speakers. And so I thought, well, it's going to be interesting to hear this guy. The minute Bill Federer began to speak, my jaw dropped, and I didn't recover until he was completely finished. I was sitting there going, I don't know that I have ever heard anyone so spellbinding as Bill Federer. I have never forgotten that first time I heard you, Bill. And it's just a great honor to welcome you to the program again.
Well, Bob, you're the great speaker, and it's an honor to be with you. And thank you for holding the torch high for all these years and championing what's right. And you're
well,
an inspiration to me.
They can't find anybody else who will work cheaper than I do. I've got to ask you, before I forget, do you have a photographic memory?
No, I just, it's just
Are you
repetition.
Serious?
No, I just talk about something enough, it comes back easy.
If someone listens to you, they would believe you have a photographic memory because your grasp, I have to have notes. I can speak extemporaneously, but it's got to be something I'm really, really familiar with, and I do not have the mental capability to handle details, dates, places, and things like you do. I can do it if I have notes. But, Bill, you don't ever breathe. Have you always been that way? Always had that ability?
No, it's just repetition. It's just I talk all the time. And
well, so do I, but I can't do what you do.
Well, I talk about the same thing over and over again. That's all it. So I've written about 20 books, but in, you know, writing the book, you have to like read through the thing 1,000 times, and then I still catch typos. But you're really imprinting it on your hard drive of your brain, so to speak, and then it's there. And then I can say that as I'm speaking, I begin to see patterns. And, you know, people say, well, history repeats itself. Really, human nature repeats itself. And when you study human nature, it just pretty well acts the same. I mean, you go to any high school and kids fall into the same categories, jocks, geeks, gossip girls, right, nerds. But you go to any period in history and people will act the same. You got somebody lusting for power and those that are kissing up to the guy in power and those that are suffering under the oppression of power and those that said, I've had enough, I'm getting out of here, right? What I've seen is the most common form of government is kings. They go by different names, Pharaoh, Caesar, Kaiser, Sultan, Tsar. But that's the default setting for human government. It's tribal. It's very much like you put some kids on a playground, one's the bully. You put some girls in a junior high clique, one's the diva. Mm-hmm. You put some people in the woods, one of them is an Indian chief, and you put them in an inner city, one of them is a gang leader. And all a king is a glorified gang leader. And so the only thing that changes over time is military advancements and technological advancements. So the gang leader can kill more people because instead of using a rock, he's using a bronze weapon or an iron weapon or a phalanx spear or a scimitar sword or a composite bow or gunpowder. Or the weapon improves, but it's that same fallen nature of Cain, Kill, and Abel. And technology improves so they can track more people. I was thinking Augustus Caesar wanted to have a worldwide tracking system. It was called the census. If he could have chipped everybody and had cameras and drone, he would have done that, right? And, you know, here's Genghis Khan. He kills from Korea to Hungary in the 1200s, kills 30 million people. If he hadn't have died, he'd have been happy to continue conquering. You know, 6 million die in the Napoleonic Wars. I mean, he would have loved to have continued conquering. Attila the Hun had an army of 500,000 men. They're wiping out cities across Europe. If he hadn't have died, he'd have been – any one of these guys could have been the Antichrist, so to speak.
Sure.
And so in that sense, death is a blessing, and the devil has to sort of start from scratch, you know. But the idea is that it's, again, the default setting. So if you were the king or somebody in the listening audience was the king, and that would be pretty cool. Until they have a sister that they really love, and she has a kid. Now he's a teenager, and he's partying, hanging around the wrong kids, drinks and drives, hits someone with a car and kills them. And now this teenager is facing manslaughter charges, mandatory prison time, and your sister comes begging to you and says, "You're the king. You're not going to let my little Johnny get locked away, are you?" What are you going to say to your own sister?
Yeah.
"Well, I'll let him off the hook this time, but don't let it happen again." As soon as you say that, you are the corrupt dictator. So it just happens. Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts, absolutely. And so what God did at the Tower of Babel is he took the power and scattered it and separated it.
Sure.
But it's almost like every generation since has tried to rebuild the Tower of Babel, only on a bigger scale because military advancements and technological advancements, and clearly there's a global goal in mind. The anomaly that stands out is ancient Israel. About 1400 B.C., they come out of Egypt, and for 400 years they don't have a king. It's like a total anomaly, and it works because every single citizen is taught the law, and every citizen is personally accountable to God to follow the law. I use the illustration of everyone has an iPhone or something like that and a GPS app. Directions. You can get from point A to point B. Imagine if there was a behavioral app that you could download, and it would tell you how to act in real time. It would sense your blood pressure going up and hear the volume of your voice, and it could run an algorithm. You're about to lose your temper at somebody, and it would say, "Alert, alert, don't lose it," right? And then it would see you in proximity of an item that's of high value, and it would see you hesitating like you're looking, and it would say, "Alert, don't steal this," right? And so the law for ancient Israel was like a behavioral app, and the Levite priests were like the computer geeks that helped people to download this app. So everybody in ancient Israel, this first 400 years out of Egypt before they got King Saul, everybody had their own behavioral app, so to speak, their own copy of the law memorized on their heart. And then the big question is, why would you follow it? What would motivate you to follow this internal moral? Ancient Israel had the key ingredient. There's a God who's watching everyone. He wants you to be fair. He's going to hold you accountable in the future. So you're about to steal, nobody's around, and then you think, God is watching me, he wants me to be fair, he's going to hold me accountable sometime in the future, maybe I should hesitate stealing. So it creates something in your head called the conscience. If everybody in the country really believes this, you can maintain complete order with no police. And so when we say it's one nation under God, mentioning God is more than just a nice little acknowledgement. It's this awareness that there is a God who is watching us, who wants us to be fair, is going to hold us accountable in the future, that motivates us to follow these internal morals, and we can keep order in society with no police. But if you get rid of this God or ignore him, then there's no motivation to follow any internal morals. It's going to turn into people using their creativity to be lustful and violent and corrupt.
And their human nature rises. Yeah. Their corrupt, fallen human nature rises to the surface and begins to control them and the culture. Because God has been taken out.
Yeah, yeah. You're tracking it right on. And so that's where my book Socialism picks up. So I talk about how that it sounds good, everybody being equal and everybody owning the same amount of stuff. But if there's no rights from a creator, then law is just something men made up. And Plato, the title of my book is Socialism, the Real History from Plato to the Present. Plato says that once the people give up morals and virtue, it's going to Matter of fact, he says the chief characteristic of a democracy is tolerance, and it's wonderful. It's like an embroidery patchwork. It's like a bazaar where you can buy any viewpoint. So the chief characteristic of a democracy is tolerance. Everybody tolerates each other. It's wonderful. Then they tolerate people that are a little bit off. Mm-hmm. Then they tolerate people that are a lot off. Till finally they're tolerating crooks and crime and fraud and broad daylight looting and random attacks, and it turns into lawlessness. And everybody says, we need someone to come along and fix this
mess. But that would never happen in America.
Socialism is basically a sales campaign for dictatorship. Right, promises heaven, delivers hell. Promises utopia, delivers dystopia. And so I trace it. Plato was the first one that talked about everything owned in common. Mm-hmm. And the scenario was, he says, democracy's doomed to fail because it's based on people having virtue, and people really don't have virtue. They tolerate each other, then they tolerate people that are off, until finally it turns to lawlessness, and then they say, we need someone to come along and fix this mess. And that's when some governor comes along and he says, I can fix it. I just need some emergency powers. And at first, they're all smiles.
Boy, does that sound familiar.
And he's, I'm going to take away your rights and freedoms, but I'm doing this to protect you. So Plato called him a protector. Yeah. When first the protector appears above ground, he's full of smiles. But then as he consolidates power, he begins to finally stand up in the chariot of state holding the reins of power. And he's revealed as the tyrant. And he's going to institute structure. He's the head of gold. His administrators are the arms and chest of silver. Together, they make up the ruling class, and everyone else is the abdomen of iron and bronze. They are the ruled class. Mm. So socialism is a structured society of a ruling class and a ruled class. The ruling class, they're above the law. They're politically connected. They can do special things like getting their hair styled when nobody else can. Right? And the ruled class, it says everybody's provided for, but nobody owns anything. The government decides who gets what. And there's a saying, whoever controls the purse strings has the power.
Sure.
So, okay, everybody's going to own everything equally. Great. Who decides who gets the stuff? Who's going to divvy it out? That person likes their job, and they're tempted to be discretionary and give their family and friends a little extra stuff. And those that are pointing out their favoritism, they want to shut up. And before you know it, you're back to a dictator. And then I fast forward to the French Revolution. We had a revolution. They had a revolution. Their motto was liberty, equality, fraternity. Liberty is experienced individually. Fraternity was their word for socialism, the fraternity, the group, the collective, the mm-hmm. social contract, mm-hmm. the mob. And equality can be understood two ways. In America, it was equal treatment before the law. In France, it was everyone having an equal amount of stuff. Mm. And if the fraternité, the group, the collective, the mob, thinks you have too much stuff, it can use the power of the state, ignore your individual liberties, take away your stuff, and even kill you. So they chopped off 30,000 heads in Paris, and then they sent their army to the Vendée, and they killed 300,000. I mean, it was a bloodbath. But out of that chaos rose a dictator named Napoleon, right? I go through, it's interesting, after World War II, Germany, France, and England gave up their former colonies, and they had brand new countries, looked hopeful, except the KGB decided to send in their agents and do critical theory. This comes from Karl Marx. Critical theory is simply observing a culture and identifying all the groups, ethnically, mm-hmm. religiously, economically, racially, and posing them as victims and oppressors, haves and have-nots, and then orchestrating protests and riots and violence, and then co-opting the media with bribes and threats to blame the new leader of the new country for all the problems. And then when everybody's panicky enough, they would do a coup or a rigged election and replace the leader with a Soviet puppet. 45 countries fell to communism this way. And these countries were called behind the Iron Curtain. Truman does nothing. He thinks that the United Nations he helped form will bring world peace. Eisenhower's the next president, and he's faced with Iran siding with the Soviet Union and nationalizing their oil. And you think, big deal, nationalizing oil in Iran? No. Britain had no oil fields. So in 1908, Britain formed the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company. You know it better as BP. And so when BP's taken away and now the Iran siding with the Soviet Union, they appeal to Eisenhower. They're having an oil shortage, and Eisenhower approves the first CIA operation to overthrow a country's leader, Operation Ajax. We send Kermit Roosevelt Jr., the grandson of Teddy Roosevelt, to Tehran, and he does the same thing in reverse. He recruits mobsters and gangsters and radical imams and stages protests and riots and co-ops the media to blame Mossadegh for all the problems. And when the country gets panicky enough, they put Mossadegh under house arrest, lock him away for the rest of his life. Where he dies, they replaced him with the Shah, who loved America because we helped put him in. But these tactics have been used for 70 years. of how to go into a country and find groups and pit them against each other right. for the sole purpose of creating domestic insurrection and rioting and chaos so that people panic in fear and beg the government. They beg someone to come in and restore order. And when the rubber band snaps back, you're no longer a free country ruling yourself bottom up. You're back to a dictator ruling top down.
So we are plummeting towards that here in America. Where are we at in this process? Bill, you are an expert on the rise and fall of nations and so forth. Where are we at in America today?
Yeah, we're on the precipice and hanging over it. And I think that if we don't have, you know, I was talking to somebody, school board elections. Hardly anybody votes for their school board members.
True.
And so this little lady goes to a meeting because they found out they're teaching critical race theory and transgenderism and all this stuff. And they just shut her off. And she, like, goes back in the room, sits there quiet the rest of the meeting, and then she goes out and organizes. She goes to all the churches, and she says, do you like what they're teaching at the schools? And they would say, well, no. And she says, okay, you show up. Here's some candidates we got. Where the normal school board member gets 500 votes, 12,000 people showed up. They voted out the entire school board. If every church simply took responsibility for their own school board races in their community, we could begin to start turning this thing around overnight. Wow. But if we don't, they've got momentum on their side, and just a couple more crises, and they'll be able to seal the deal.
I knew our time was going to go extremely fast. Tell our listeners how they can pick up their copy of Socialism, the Real History from Plato to the Present.
Well, thank you. Amazon, of course, but my website is AmericanMinute.com. We get a little bit more if you order from our website, AmericanMinute.com. Also, send out a free daily history email. And, of course, today's is on Constitution Day.
It's wonderful. I read it earlier today. It's wonderful. AmericanMinute.com. You can sign up for that. It's free. It comes to your inbox every single day. You've got to sign up for it, and you must get Socialism, the Real History from Plato to the Present. Don't go to Amazon. Go to AmericanMinute.com. AmericanMinute.com. My guest, William J. Federer, F-E-D-E-R-E-R. Bill, can't wait to hear you tonight at the Ohio Christian Alliance Banquet. Thank you for dropping by. I know you're incredibly busy.
Well, thank you, Bob. And it's great to be here with Chris Long and the Ohio Christian Alliance.
Thanks for listening to Christian Outlook. Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. If you enjoy our podcast, take a moment and tell a friend to subscribe today.
How can we harness the power of the private sector to reduce plastic waste? On the latest episode of Sustainably Speaking, we talk with Julie Sinewski, Sustainability Director at Dow, and Bridget Croak, Managing Director of Closed Loop Partners, about companies investing in solutions that increase the amount of recycled plastic available to meet the growing demand for recycled content in products and packaging. Tune in and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.